Good afternoon, Happy New Year, and welcome to Little Atoms, with me, Richard Sanderson, and Neil Denny. Little Atoms comes from a perspective which is rationalist, atheist, humanist, and for the progressive left. For the next hour, we'll be chatting to the journalist, blogger, and author, Oliver Cam. But first, we'll have a little bit more music by Kev Hopper, and I'll take this opportunity to thank him, because I forgot to bring in the CD, and he was able to email us in the form of an MP3, so we were saved. So thanks a lot for that, Kev. I know you're probably picking your kids up now. In a few minutes, Neil will introduce Oliver Cam.
Welcome back to Little Atoms. We're joined today by Oliver Cam. Welcome to the show, Oliver.
Thank you.
Oliver writes a popular weblog and is a regular contributor to the Times newspaper. He has recently written a book, Anti-Totalitarianism, The Left-Wing Case for a Neoconservative Foreign Policy. Now, the use of the term neoconservative here is quite provocative. It's normally associated with the right wing, and for somebody like yourself who's firmly positioning yourself on the left, it's an interesting term, and of course you're one of the media's more prominent supporters of the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq as well. The main theme of your book, though, is that these interventions can be seen as a continuance of a long-standing commitment by the left to fight totalitarianism. Now, you actually say yourself in the preface to the book, this is going to take some arguing, so here's your opportunity. Could you expand on this, please, Oliver?
That's very kind. It's a neoconservative foreign policy. And I adopt the adjective neoconservative, partly provocatively, but partly to save a bit of time. The neoconservative movement, it is often forgotten and often not understood, does in fact have its roots on the, if not the American left, then certainly American liberalism. The term neoconservative initially was a term of abuse. In the mid-1970s, American liberals were deeply split over the issue of national security. The Vietnam War had had a disastrous impact on the Democratic Party. The old Cold War liberals were perceived to be discredited. A new radical wing of the Democratic Party became prominent, and a candidate of that wing was selected as the was nominated as the Democratic presidential candidate in 1972. In the mid-1970s, the traditional Cold War liberals became disaffected with the way the Democratic Party was going. Many of them were grouped around Senator Henry Scoop Jackson, a man whose name has lately come back into the news in this country. And in reaction to those disaffected liberals, the term neoconservative was born. It was a term of abuse. It was coined by an American socialist leader, Michael Harrington, to describe those formerly on the left, some of them Trotskyites, who were now very much perceived to be Cold War hawks. My view is that the term neoconservative has now essentially become part of the conservative movement. There are many American conservatives who interpret their neoconservatism as support for an interventionist foreign policy and railing against the cultural changes that were wrought in the 1960s. Mm. Now, I'm very much in favour of the cultural changes that were wrought in the 1960s. I think the legislative and cultural shifts on issues of race, sexual equality, acceptance of homosexuality and legal rights for homosexuals are very much a civilizing influence. They've done tremendous good in the space of a generation. And because those who support an interventionist foreign policy, as I do, and we'll come on to the reasons and the background of that, are often tarred with the term neoconservative, I think, well, why bother arguing against it? Let's appropriate the term for ourselves. I mean, many terms in history have been used as terms of abuse, Methodist, for example, and later appropriated by their targets. There does seem to be a need for a description of a foreign policy stance that is interventionist, liberal democratic internationalist in its principles, but a little more sceptical of international institutions than traditional liberalism because of our experience of them. I therefore don't particularly see a need to evade the term neoconservative foreign policy. We might as well use it for ourselves while making clear, certainly in my case, my distinction on matters of domestic policy, social issues, and economic policy from those the term is usually levelled at.
I've never been quite clear on what the conservative opinion of the phrase neoconservative is. I mean, surely they would, if they like it, would prefer it to be known as conservatism.
I think that's right. And if you look at the views of the most prominent neoconservatives in the United States, people like Irving Kristol, Norman Podhoretz, I mean, they don't really, well, in the first case, Irving Kristol has actually never been a particular advocate of the spreading of democracy in foreign policy, and so is a case apart. Norman Podhoretz, a very prominent, in effect, the father of American neoconservatism, the longtime editor of Commentary magazine, has lately argued that there is no essential difference any longer between neoconservatism and conservatism. Now, if people like that are abandoning the term neoconservative, and if people like us are being accused of neoconservatism, it seems to me to save a bit of time just to occupy the space that has lately been vacated.
It's interesting that you mention in the book as well that Podhoretz has started publishing things in commentary about the creationist movement as well, which is as far away from how we would certainly like to position ourselves as liberals.
I'm very much with you on that one. Commentary, like Norman Podhoretz himself, has gone through many philosophical shifts in its long life. It's part of the culture of American political commentary. I've been a long-time subscriber to it. I don't accept its philosophical premises in many respects. I'm an interventionist on foreign policy. I'm more sympathetic to the Israeli peace movement, not a supporter of it, but more sympathetic to the Israeli peace movement than many neoconservatives. And on cultural issues, the things that Norman Podhoretz has run in the magazine, denying Darwin, opposing gay marriage, these things are very far from my own views.
Okay, well, can we expand a bit on the sort of the examples from the history of the left in Britain, particularly that you've used as examples of what we're calling now a neoconservative foreign policy, but in the past?
History never repeats itself, but the left needs an awareness of history if it's going to come up with anything sensible on foreign policy. The easiest charge to make in foreign policy discussion is just to go back to the 1930s and say appeaser, or go back to the 1914-18 war and say arms race. Neither of those stereotypes is particularly useful in foreign policy debate. I start my book, well, my book takes the form of an analysis of the debates on the left over four different historical episodes. First, collective security and the arguments over how to resist aggression in the 1930s. Secondly, the post-1945 era and the beginnings of the Cold War. Thirdly, the change in position of the mainstream left in the broadly from the early 1970s through the 1980s, rejecting that Cold War inheritance adopting, in the case of the British Labour Party, unilateral nuclear disarmament as a policy, and in the case of many European Social Democrats, opposition to cruise and Pershing missiles. And the fourth historical episode I look at is the post 9/11 policy of regime change, of which I am a supporter. There are no exact historical analogies, but I do believe that if you look at the earlier historical debates, you can learn something about current political discussions. The main one I draw is not that the critics of regime change are appeasers, a charge I've never made and do not believe, but that they mistakenly see collective security as an alternative to war. The lesson of the 1930s, and I think there are lessons of the 1930s, is above all that sometimes collective security requires the exercise of power, and the exercise of power requires the use of military force. Mm-hmm. So that's the first historical lesson I take relevant to our own discussions.
Surely we can call some of them appeasers, can't we? I mean, the particular one I'm thinking of can't hear us because he's in the Big Brother house, and I don't think they can get Resonance FM on there. But.
I think the gentleman you're referring to or alluding to is particularly litigious, so I will keep his name out of it.
Michael Barrymore's litige.
I think that the people you're referring to, I mean, let's look at the anti-war critics as a whole. I think that you can divide the opposition to regime change into two broad camps. I mean, the first are the most vocal, but much the smaller camp, the organised anti-war movement grouped around the Stop the War Coalition, the Respect Coalition, and the Socialist Workers' Party, for which the first two are essentially arms or front organisations. They are one organisation, in effect, not three. My argument, well, let me go forward a stage. Another of the guests on this show, I'm not sure if he has been a guest or is going to be a guest, is Nick Cohen, the Observer and New Statesman columnist.
He's the next guest, and he has been a guest on this station. I've chatted to Nick about 2.5 years ago.
Well, Nick's argument in the New Statesman and other places is that there is something quite new on the revolutionary left at the moment, and that is an alliance between essentially Leninism and Islamism. He argues that there is something very new here, the overthrowing of the left's tradition of secularism and its allying with religious, even theocratic elements. My argument is that what he sees as very new, in fact, is very, very old. Mm. There are, here again, the discussion goes back to the 1930s. If you read a phenomenal book that has certainly influenced Nick very much, and me too, by Paul Berman, called Terror and Liberalism.
It's also influenced the two of us very much.
Berman discusses debates in the 1930s, particularly on the French left. He's very much a Francophile. He studied the French left very much. And if you look at the debates on the French left at that time, the notion that Germany had a valid historical complaint over punitive conditions in the Treaty of Versailles steadily shifted into the view that there was a real historical dynamic in the movements shaping Germany in the 1930s, and France had no particular reason to stand in the way of them. It was a minority view on the left, but it was a very powerful one. My view is that the far left, we know what we're talking about, the far left supporters of the so-called insurgents in Iraq essentially hark back to that tradition. The idea that there is something, if not extenuating, even romantic about totalitarianism, in fact, goes back to those debates. And I would say that the movements we're talking about, Respect, Stop the War, SWP, have moved from the far left to the far right, and this movement is the most vocal, the most corrosive, and in many respects the most loudly anti-Semitic element in British society at the moment. That, of course, does not describe the great majority, that huge movement that came out to demonstrate in the Iraq War, that stemmed from many philosophical and religious or moral impulses, many different political standpoints and none. But in my view, in almost no case arguing an anti-war position that reflected the world as it is. The nearest I can think of to a really thoroughgoing anti-war case that might have made sense was the position of the American philosopher, socialist, editor of the Dissent magazine, Michael Walzer, who argued that inspections should be given time to work, so far so normal, so good, mm-hmm. And that in order to take a consistent anti-war position, the anti-war movement needed to argue not for respecting of sovereignty. Heaven knows Iraq's sovereignty was heavily compromised and there was no legitimate sovereign authority in place. There was a gangster regime oppressing a nation, or rather a group of peoples. But the anti-war movement needed to argue for, in effect, a much more invasive movement, a humanitarian interventionist movement, and international authority needed to be the agent of those principles. My view is that doesn't describe the world as it is at the moment. International authority, or rather supranational authority, had demonstrably failed in the case of Iraq, and it had failed to protect our own civilians, or the United States citizens, and Western security from a new totalitarian threat. Totalitarian threat that is not imminent in the sense that Nazi Germany was a threat, but is inevitable, I feel, unless we extirpate it at its roots. We can go on to a discussion of root causes,
a cliche that's
often invoked. But in my view, the far left, far right, whatever you want to call them, pretty much the same animal, is a small part of the anti-war movement, but a very vocal one, and with clear roots in the debates in the 1930s. The rest of the anti-war movement one can argue with on a much more rational basis.
Well, it's ironic, and you do mention this in the book, that the anti-war, I mean, possibly not the extreme ones, but the more sort of reasonable wing, are basically, presumably, you know, a lot of them would consider themselves to be of the left again, but they're actually arguing a position that was, you know, that most recently was taken by the conservative government over Bosnia, a sort of realist argument, and I find that quite ironic.
I think that's exactly the right analogy. The argument of the late Robin Cook, much the most effective of the anti-war critics in this country, and whose death is a very sad loss to foreign policy debate, wrote in The Independent in 2004 that the Iraq War was the greatest mistake in British foreign policy since Suez. Martin Bell has argued very much the same thing. I say in the book, somewhat provocatively, but I do believe it, that Iraq was in fact the most strategically far-sighted and noble venture in British foreign policy since the founding of NATO. The most disastrous episode in British foreign policy since Suez was in fact the debacle over Bosnia under the last Conservative government. It was not only a moral catastrophe, but it also led, if you read, for example, Brendan Sim's book on British policy in that era, it also led to the greatest rift in transatlantic relations since Suez. What was wrong with the policy was what Brendan calls a conservative pessimism, what I call an amoral quietism, because I don't think it even had particularly well-defined philosophical roots, took hold of foreign policy in the major government. A very restricted view of what constituted national interests was held as the be-all and end-all of foreign policy. That very restricted view led to our not taking sides in a clear case of an aggressor against a victim. It was a moral catastrophe that was not only an affront to our values, but had serious strategic implications as well. The shift in foreign policy debate, I think, since 9/11, when clearly, beyond any argument, because of the terrible carnage of that day, the shift in foreign policy debate since then is the convergence of the view that I hold on Bosnia and held at the time, that we had moral interventionist obligations as liberal internationalists, and the view that we have a real strategic necessity in intervening to remove the roots of terror, to remove the causes of theocratic fanaticism which is now being directed against us. If I may mention once again the name of Henry Jackson, the late US Democratic senator who stood unsuccessfully twice for the Democratic presidential nomination in the 1970s, and whose name has been revived in the Henry Jackson Society established late last year in this country. The great convergence in foreign policy now is across left and right. The Henry Jackson Society has supporters across the political spectrum in both parties. The belief that our own national interests are served by being for the liberty of others. There's a very cogent conclusion to Paul Berman's book along those lines. I think that we serve ourselves, we protect ourselves by serving others, by being for the freedom of others. And that is why I think there is this interesting informal alliance between those on the left, like me, who've always believed in liberal democratic internationalism, and those on the conservative wing of politics who see the disaster of the foreign policy of the last conservative government.
I'm very taken with that phrase you used of conservative pessimism or quietism.
It wasn't mine.
Okay, well, I forget who actually did come up with that. But I'm wondering whether you see that same conservative pessimism in the left now. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of some of the arguments that were used against the intervention in Iraq, and it did seem to me that it was heading almost into the sort of isolationism that America was previously being criticised so heavily for.
I think that's absolutely the issue, and even before you get to isolationism, you reach a position of foreign policy realism, so-called. The realist case assumes that what matters in foreign policy, the traditional analogy is the billiard table. What matters in foreign policy is not the internal composition of states, but the way that they relate to each other. On the billiard table, you don't know what's in the billiard ball, you can't see it. What matters is not that essence which is opaque, but how the billiard balls interact with each other. International relations, in the realist view, is like that. Mm-hmm. Nations don't have friends, they have interests and they have allies. That's typically associated, not exclusively associated, but typically associated with a conservative, with a small c view of politics, where politics is the art of the possible. We shouldn't have, there's a very cogent philosophical case for this, so we shouldn't have an end vision of society. We should deal with the task of government as we deal with steering a ship of state. This is true in domestic policy. It's even more true in foreign affairs, where there is no supranational legal authority mm-hmm. that exercises sovereignty over states' behaviour. That's a very influential, very coherent view of international affairs. But it's not one, I think, that belongs on, let alone should appeal to, those of left-wing internationalist views who, when they see oppression, should wish to overturn it. The debate since 9/11 ought to have taken a very simple form, not a simplistic form, but a very simple form. Here is a theocratic totalitarian movement with a clear philosophical lineage going back to earlier episodes of totalitarianism on our own continent. If you doubt me, read Berman's book. He goes into the philosophical roots of it at great length. And the founders of Baathism, which we have lately been fighting in Iraq, and I hope we will lately see or soon see overthrown in Syria, go back to students at the Sorbonne in the 1930s, or those who were studying at Sorbonne in the 1930s who were impressed with European fascism and explicitly modelled Baathism on the European movements of that time. What we have now is a left that, as you rightly imply, is conservative in its view because it fears for the stability of the region that we have intervened in and doesn't see that what was actually stable was extremely destructive. This slum of autocratic states in the region, which suppressed political dissent, and because there was no outlet for political dissent, it took the only form it could in the mosque, in organized religion. And I mentioned root causes. I think much of the discussion of root causes of terrorism is purely speculative. If one can, however, identify a single root cause of the terrorist movements that have threatened us, it is the waves of hatred that have built up in a fanatical form of religion in parts of the world that have not known democratic constitutional government. And the left ought to be making common cause with those who seek the spread of constitutional government and the values that we hold dear in parts of the world that have not been open to scientific inquiry, liberal political rights, sexual equality, and so forth.
You mentioned in your writing the fact that a lot of people have said, well, you know, it's poverty that is causing this. And I wonder if you'd like to tackle that, because it is a fairly persuasive argument. People say, you know, there's a lot of poor people in these countries. They see America going around bossing everybody about. And it was a way to hit back at them. I'm speaking specifically on September the 11th here.
Can I just elaborate on that, though, before you answer that, Oliver? Because I was going to ask exactly the same question, and there's a great quote in your book here from Reverend Neil Richardson, who's a Methodist minister, and this is after the Madrid bombings in 2004. And it's a great quote. It's quite amusing because he basically contradicts himself within the quote. But the perpetrators of the Madrid bombings and their particular motivations have not yet been identified. But what is incontestable is that global terrorism, of which Spain is the most recent victim, is bred by injustice and deprivation. Western nations, therefore, need critically to examine their foreign policy.
It's a model of a bad argument.
It's fantastic. He's obviously psychic as well, because he, although claiming not to know who's done the deed, is putting ideas into the head anyway.
I'm afraid that there is a tendency, particularly among liberal Protestant clergymen, to say much the same thing. What can one say? How can one put it? What the former president of the Methodist Conference was saying in his official capacity immediately after the Madrid bombings is a speculative hypothesis. There are enormous moral grounds for tackling world poverty. There is a humanitarian and liberal imperative for changing our aid policies. But the idea that if we tackle one huge moral issue, we are tackling another, it just doesn't follow. And the empirical research suggests that that particular argument is not, in fact, correct. If you look at the studies that have been done, there have been quite a few of the links between terrorism and a number of social pathologies. The only really consistent relationships you find are terrorism tends to be connected with larger rather than smaller countries. Well, that tends to figure because there's a bigger population from which terrorists may be recruited. And also there tends to be some relationship between terrorism and the Freedom House Index of political liberty. Terrorists tend to be from more autocratic states rather than from democracies. If it were poverty, you would expect the principal terrorist threat to be from sub-Saharan Africa. It is, in fact, from, as we know, countries that are heavily influenced by or have very strong Islamist movements. The thesis that many academics advance is that in a society where there is no outlet for political dissidents, then political dissidents will take the nearest or only available form, which in the case of countries like Saudi Arabia is religious fanaticism of a peculiarly obscurantist, fundamentalist kind. And that seems to me a hypothesis that makes a lot more sense than the Reverend Richardson's argument, and is one that accords with, whether you like it or not, the national security doctrines of the current Bush administration, which, whatever criticisms you make of its execution of foreign policy, has actually got a grip on what we ought to be doing, even if it isn't doing it in a particularly sensible or diplomatic way.
I have to say, it does, though, take quite a huge leap of imagination for us people of the left to go along with the idea that George W. Bush has just grabbed hold of this idea of promoting liberty rather than sticking to the typical realpolitik idea of American foreign policy. And a lot of the, you know, the things that we've been against in the past, from Vietnam right through to East Timor to Central America, have all been in that vein. And obviously, you know, somebody like... I can't remember his name. I've gone completely blank. Who are we talking about?
No idea.
Has Christopher Hitchens has written the book to indict?
Henry Kissinger,
of course. Yes. Apologies for that. Yeah. Sorry about that, Henry. And it was it's obviously the sort of, you know, the bogeyman of that sort of idea. And suddenly, is it all down to, you know, 9/11 that Bush has just suddenly come round and decided? Because it does, as I said, it does take quite a leap of imagination to be on that side, I think.
Yes, it does. But look at the chronology here. Let's look at the recent chronology, and then let's go back a stage. In the most recent general election campaign, it was the view of, for example, Professor Richard Dawkins, who on some issues this radio program would be very close to,
very much so, yes.
That a vote for Blair was a vote for Bush, and he made that argument in the context of the campaign in Tony Blair's own constituency by an independent candidate, an independent anti-war candidate, Reg Keyes, who behaved very, very dignified way after the murder of his son on service in Iraq. That argument seems to me to have it exactly the wrong way round. If you look at the experience of the Labour government since it came to office in 1997, what stands out is that a Prime Minister with very little previous interest or obvious interest in foreign policy before he became Prime Minister has committed British troops to a succession of campaigns, all of them absolutely right in my view, and all of them with the same axiom, all of them with the same principle behind it, which is that we have a humanitarian imperative related also to our security to deal with threats of fanaticism on our own continent and elsewhere. A humanitarian imperative. George Bush is quite late in coming round to the same view. I mean, Tony Blair was arguing this in a very well-known speech in 1999. George Bush in the 2000 presidential election was arguing very much a more conservative realpolitik case, similar to the one that his father, as the first President Bush, practiced in foreign policy, similar to the one that Henry Kissinger practiced as Secretary of State in the 1970s. It is not the role of the United States to go about nation building, the pregnant phrase that he dismissed. And that was the principal reason that I, as a liberal European, was quite fearful of a Bush presidency, and the exact opposite from what someone like Professor Dawkins would say is the risk of a Bush presidency or the danger of a Bush presidency. I felt that the United States under a Republican administration was likely to cut and run in the Balkans, strike a deal with Saddam over oil, and withdraw from humanitarian commitments overseas. What has actually happened is that 9/11 has had a remarkable effect on foreign policy in the United States. Gone is a tradition which you rightly refer to of Cold War realpolitik and alliances with authoritarian regimes for, so it was thought, the wider good of confronting and containing communism. And in its place is a doctrine that that says that the liberty of others is the security of us. And the argument that the left should be making is not a reflexive opposition to the United States and a reflexive opposition to a US administration whose domestic views we would reject, but to try to hold it to account for a security doctrine that seems to me absolutely unexceptionable, and Tony Blair has been quite right to ally with. So I would say, ditch the reflexive anti-Americanism, look at the facts and look at the record.
A vote for Bush is a vote for Blair.
I think that's probably right, yes.
Shall we pause for some music at that point?
What is it, Neil?
This is The Mountain Goats and You or Your Memory.
Checked into a bargain price room on La Cienega. Gazed out through the curtains of the parking lot. Walked down to the corner store just before nightfall in my bare feet. Black tarry asphalt, soft and hot. And when I came back, I spread out my supplies on the counter by the sink, looked myself right in the eyes. St. Joseph's baby aspirin, Bartles and James, and you, or your memory. I ducked behind the drapes when I saw the moon begin to rise. Gathered in my loose ends, switched off the light. And down there in the dark, I could see the real truth about me, as clear as day. Lord, if I make it through tonight, then I will mend my ways and walk the straight path. End of my day, St. Joseph's baby aspirin, Bartles and James, and you, or your memory.
Welcome back. You're listening to Residence 104.4 FM. This is Little Atoms with Richard Sanderson and me, Neil Denny, and we're talking to Oliver Cam.
Oliver, in the discussion we were having earlier, you mentioned a few times Henry Jackson, Henry Scoop Jackson, and specifically the Henry Jackson Society, and I'm a little unclear on what this is. I know, I believe you're a signatory to it, at least, so could you expand a little on what the Henry Jackson Society is and what it does?
The Henry Jackson Society is an educational group set up last year and launched at a very crowded House of Commons reception right at the end of last year. It's named for a man I've previously mentioned, Senator Henry Scoop Jackson, sometime Democratic presidential hopeful, or hopeful for the nomination in the 1970s. Scoop Jackson was, early in his political career, an isolationist who had a cathartic experience when he was invited by, right at the end of the war, or immediately on the conclusion of the war, was invited by an American military commander with a number of other congressmen to inspect one of the recently liberated concentration camps. I forget which one it was. I think it was Buchenwald, 11 days after it was liberated. That event was a shattering one, as you can well imagine, on Jackson personally, and indeed on his political thinking. He became ever after known as the principal advocate of liberal anti-totalitarianism in Congress, where he served for many, many years. And his position has often been misrepresented. He was a great expert on defense issues, and he is often seen as, and was often seen at the time, as a reflexive Cold War warrior. He wasn't. He was a disinterested advocate of human rights, and that led him to favor trade, coercive trade means on the Soviet Union to ease restrictions on Jewish emigration. Mm-hmm. He also detested apartheid. He was a strong supporter of Israel on moral grounds, though not Jewish himself. He was a liberal Protestant Niebuhrian thinker. And he died in the early 1980s, having been a great defense expert and a man greatly respected by both wings of politics, and has largely been forgotten in political debate on both sides of the Atlantic. A number of people, myself included, have always regarded him as almost a political model. Many of his ideas are no longer applicable. He was very much an FDR New Dealer in economics, and if you look at some of his economic ideas in the 1970s, Nixon wasn't tough enough on wage and price controls, he argued. I mean, these are no longer relevant to our policy discussions. But he was a liberal in the American sense. He was an early conservationist. He was a desegregationist. And he was an advocate of a strong democratic commitment in US foreign policy. Now, these ideas seem to a number of people to be even more relevant now than they were in Jackson's lifetime. A group of, in the first instance, Cambridge academics and Cambridge historians, one of them, Dr. Brendan Sims, I've already mentioned, having written a magnificent book on the failings of British foreign policy over Bosnia, set up the society. It has attracted broad support on both sides of the House of Commons, more Conservative MPs than Labour MPs, but Labour MPs there as well. A number of columnists and writers, including myself, people of military background, not to be, as its critics charge, a neocon cabal. I'm not a neoconservative, and probably few members of the Henry Jackson Society or signatories of the Henry Jackson Society take that label.
I have to say, I run a mile whenever I hear anybody using the word cabal. It rings alarm bells with me.
Yes, I use it in an ironic sense.
Yes.
And the Society, I hope, will have an important effect on British political debate, not in being a promoter of neoconservatism, as I say, I'm not a neoconservative myself, but in arguing the case for holding democracy and the spread of democracy as the first point or the first principle of foreign policy, and arguing for an interventionist foreign policy on grounds of both ethics and strategic sense.
Well, you answered that perfectly for me.
If we could move on to something that is going to be a great interest to a lot of Resonance listeners. Prospect Magazine recently had a poll to discover the world's most popular public intellectual. And this poll was won by Noam Chomsky, somebody that you've had regular disagreements with. And he actually contributed an article after the award was given, basically. And
yes.
Because basically you were decrying the giving of the award. And if I can just quote from that. In his book Public Intellectuals, A Study of Decline, Richard Posner notes that a successful academic may be able to use his success to reach the general public on matters about which he is an idiot. Judging by caustic remarks elsewhere in the book, he was thinking about Noam Chomsky. He was not wrong.
He was not wrong.
He was not wrong.
Noam Chomsky is a noted academic in a very specialist, quite esoteric field, that of theoretical linguistics, on which I'm not competent to comment, but fortunately I have two regular correspondents and friends who are very distinguished theoretical linguists who were able to advise me on that side of Chomsky's work when I was writing that article. But not being competent to comment on that, on Chomsky's academic discipline, I will leave that to one side. Because, of course, the reason Chomsky was voted the world's top public intellectual was almost certainly not, or not primarily, his contribution to theoretical linguistics, which itself is very much contested by my friends who are themselves professors of linguistics. The reason he was voted, he received this informal accolade, was almost certainly because his popular critiques of American foreign policy are very well known, very popular, among quite a limited segment of the population. I don't mean this in any pejorative or patronising way.
Extremely well distributed, though. I mean, if you go into a bookshop and look at the selection on foreign policy, then you will see, and they've got very striking covers as well, you'll see a lot of Chomsky's books.
Phenomenally popular, and what is even more impressive as a marketing phenomenon is that they are usually not from mainstream publishers, they're from alternative publishers. Mm-hmm. They are phenomenally popular, and they're very popular with, this is the point I was going to make, and it will sound pejorative, and it's not intended to be, very popular with people of college age. He has a huge following among college-age students. Sorry, that's tautology, isn't it? College-age students. But nonetheless, he is hugely popular. And if you look at the comments they post on the internet on various adulatory sites, somewhere like MediaLens, for example, or its American equivalents, they have the air almost of a religious experience.
It's like a
conversion
cult.
Experience. Yeah. It is like a cult. And this I find very worrying. For example, Professor Chomsky wrote a rather... wrote a very caustic and rather ill-tempered reply to my piece in the current issue of Prospect magazine, where he actually very clearly makes a mistake in quoting himself, and a point I put on my own website. It's very difficult to find a Chomskyite or a supporter of Professor Chomsky's view. I'm very concerned not to use any noun that might be taken as dismissive or patronising. It's very difficult to find any supporter of Chomsky's views on foreign policy who will even acknowledge that he can make a mistake. Mm. I think what's weak about Professor Chomsky's work in politics is much more serious than that. He is a very important figure in theoretical linguistics. He's a very important figure in the history of political campaigning and polemic in the 20th century, but he is not an important figure in the study of history. His books are very largely, not entirely, but very largely pieced together from interviews from uncritical interlocutors. Those books that do take the form of a sustained study and argument about a particular historical epoch or movement do not pass muster as history. He is not cited in historical journals. He has never published a peer-reviewed paper on politics or modern history. And if you look at the apparatus of supposed scholarship that underlie his books, the pages and pages of footnotes and endnotes, they don't stand up. His use of source material is, and I use a euphemism of a very extreme kind, unscholarly. That was the point I was making, or one of the most important points I was making in my critique of Chomsky in Prospect magazine, that on the issue where he was almost certainly put to the top of that poll, his studies of foreign policy and politics, his works cannot be considered of any scholarly value whatsoever.
He's very, he's also doesn't like to be told he's wrong. It would seem to be the impression I get. I'm unaware of any particular instance where he's actually said, yeah, you got me on that.
That's absolutely right. I know of no instance. Christopher Hitchens, a long-time friend of Chomsky, who famously had an exchange with him after 9/11 and parted company very strongly with Chomsky's views on that point, put it rather delicately when he said Chomsky has never taken criticism very well, but nonetheless made the excuse for Chomsky that he's sometimes been unfairly attacked. Well, that may be, but I think Chomsky is very much not the victim in this. His invective against those who disagree with him, Hitchens among others, is legendary. He accused me in his article in Prospect this month of various failings, cold indifference to the victims of oppression, I think. Cold indifference was the phrase that stood out. Noam Chomsky has accused many, many more distinguished men than I of much worse than that. The phrases tend to be roughly similar. Stalinism, apologetics for state violence. These are the sorts of phrases he uses against, as I say, many more distinguished men than I, and some of them very great men indeed. Václav Havel, Abba Iban, the late Israeli statesman, Christopher Hitchens himself, Michael Ignatieff, and others who criticise him. What is most remarkable about Chomsky's record, if you look back over 25, 30, 40 years, is that he will level these accusations against people who disagree with him politically, many of whom stand on the moderate wing or the liberal wing or the left wing of politics as I do myself. If you look at the way he behaved on one of the issues that notoriously diminished his reputation in the 1980s, when he came to the defence of a French Holocaust denier, a man called Trolisson, his rhetoric was very different indeed. Chomsky's supporters claim that he was merely defending the right to free speech, even of an odious man of unsanitary views. My argument, it's a very, very long issue which we haven't got time for, haven't got time to go into detail about. My argument is that, in fact, that is to misrepresent Chomsky's position. He said rather more than that and rather worse than that. But the least you could have said, the least you would have thought Chomsky would say about a man who denies the Holocaust took place and believes that the Holocaust is a hoax concocted by international jury, the least you could say about such a man is describe his politics as they are. Because here, after all, is a man who, more than anyone else in public life, could be described as a racist, an anti-Semite, and an apologist for state violence, because he denies that the greatest atrocity committed by any state in modern history ever took place. Yet does Chomsky use against Polisson the language that he uses against Václav Havel, Abba Iban, and at a much lower level of importance? Me? No, he does not.
And he hardly needed the seal of approval. Well, not seal of approval, but a seal of respectability, perhaps, that Chomsky gave him.
It was a terrible intervention and most disreputable one.
Yeah. Well, I was going to quote from his reply to your article in Prospect there, because he basically... I turned with interest to Oliver Kahn's critique of the crude and dishonest arguments he attributes to me, hoping to learn something. And learn something I did, though not quite what Kahn intended, rather about the lengths to which some will go to prevent exposure of state crimes and their own complicity in them. So you've gone from writing a not very nice article about him to being complicit in state crimes there. That's quite a leap.
It is a huge leap, and it's, as I say, I'm very much not exceptional as a critic of Chomsky receiving that type of response, and I'm given the quality and wisdom of man to whom he's directed much worse things to say, I'm flattered beyond measure by him.
So is it a similar argument has taken place in the Emma Brock Guardian controversy of recently, where in the interview she quoted him as saying, you can elaborate on this actually better.
Yes. There are limits to what I can say for a reason I'll explain in a moment.
Sure.
Emma Brock, a young Guardian feature writer, a very talented one, interviewed Noam Chomsky in light of his accolade of being voted top public intellectual in the Prospect poll. Professor Chomsky maintained that Emma Brock misrepresented his views on Bosnia and specifically the massacre at Srebrenica by eliding the distinction between his own views and those of a notorious writer on Balkan affairs, not an informed or well-educated one in any respect, Diana Johnston. The Guardian received complaints from Professor Chomsky and upheld those complaints and withdrew the interview from its site. I and a number of other people believe that the terms of that correction issued by the Guardian's reader's editor were themselves manifestly incorrect. Two other writers with knowledge of Chomsky's methods, David Aronovich and Francis Ween, and I wrote a very long, very detailed letter which we sent to the Guardian reader's editor, Ian Mays, who wrote a column saying that he had received it and considered that he was not the right authority to deal with it. Quite rightly, in my view, quite properly, because he is supposed to be the custodian of complaints against the newspaper. If we are complaining about him and his decision, he can't very well sit in adjudication on himself. The fact that David Aronovich, Francis Ween and I sent this letter, that it's very long, very detailed, and that we concluded that Emma Brock's interview with Chomsky was essentially a fair account of his opinions, is in the public domain. Because we wish to exhaust the Guardian's appeals procedure before before making the contents of that letter public. I can't go into the details of it.
Sure.
But let us say that Professor Chomsky received an apology and a correction from The Guardian, which my friends, colleagues and I believe was in itself not correct. And we have made our views known to The Guardian, wish to exhaust its appeals procedure in making that position known.
Okay, so we've got a little longer. I was going to say we're running out of time, but...
I wonder if we can do, I mean, really, it deserves a lot more than the 2 minutes that we're going to do it, but obviously we've had the recent news about Ariel Sharon in Israel, and you wrote an article on your blog, which basically looked at this event in a somewhat pessimistic light. Do you think things are looking dark over there now?
Yes, I do. I'm not hopeful. I think that Ariel Sharon surprised very many people, surprised almost everyone. He is a politician who has not once but twice been disgraced in Israeli public life and retired from it, who was elected as Prime Minister in reaction to the failure of the Oslo peace process, a very noble cause that was undermined by the obduracy, duplicity and simple untrustworthiness of one man, Yasser Arafat. In his time as Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon has surprised everyone by taking on the obscurantist of the political right, speaking openly of the occupation of Palestinian territories that must end, and aiming explicitly for an independent Palestinian state, all of which I think is overdue and I very much favour. Yet at the same time, Ariel Sharon has protected Israeli security interests very effectively by building the separation fence to make sure that suicide bombers cannot get through, and hitting very hard at terrorist organisations, even to the point of assassinating its leaders. A very difficult thing for a democratic country to do, and a very difficult case to argue, but one that I think was actually necessary. He was on the way to creating what in the American term was a vital centre of Israeli politics, this massive feeling for peace and the need to establish the sort of political relations that could lead to a Pacific Palestinian state alongside a secure Israel. To my enormous regret, his passing as Prime Minister, I believe he's still alive, but he certainly won't be Prime Minister any longer. To my enormous regret, the prospects for a political movement of that broad centre in Israeli politics, expressing the principles of defensive deterrence and territorial accommodation, I think that cause is now unlikely to be realised, and for that reason I'm not hopeful.
Well, I'm very sorry to end the interview on such a pessimistic note, and in that particular respect. I think we're getting towards the end. So, Oliver Cam, thank you very much for coming in. You do keep a blog, a regularly updated blog. I suspect the easiest way to find it is to put your name into Google, isn't it, or any search engine. Oliver's surname is spelled K-A-M-M, I should probably mention. So Oliver Cam into Google would get it, or if you'd like, you can give the address.
It's Oliver Cam, that's one word, .typepad, that's one word, .com. There is another Oliver Cam, the only one either of us has ever found in the world, who is an HIV-positive Manhattan art dealer, a splendid man who also has his own website, and that will come up in Google. We are often mistaken for each other. I quite often get letters from his boyfriends who are quite disappointed that I don't remember them.
And our website is www.littleatoms.com, and you can download some previous interviews on there.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with Nick Cohen, who was mentioned earlier on the show. So, Nick Cohen on Little Atoms, 2 weeks' time. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.